Chapter 10 Sport, the Risks of Intensification. Sport, unlike the office work we have just surveyed, is an ancient part of Western and indeed of human life. Today, only a few scholars care about the operations of Roman and medieval administration, whereas images of the Greek Olympics are still vivid thanks to the revival of the games by Pierre de Coubertin more than a century ago. The attraction appears almost universal. Even countries sharply critical of European influence have generally competed in the games rather than abstained. For better or worse, Western concepts and customs rule international sport. In fact, even judo is a European-influenced version of Japanese martial arts, and the system of colored belts was introduced only in 1927 in London. Coubertin's revival of the discus and javelin re-established these field events after millennia, and contemporary statues and vase paintings of Greek athletes have a striking immediacy. For all of the world's identification with the athletes of antiquity, we are also conscious of a distance from them. Part of it is religious. The Church rejected athletics as a holy calling, making occasional and partial exceptions for medieval warrior monks and 19th-century muscular Christian schoolboys. More of the gap is ethical and technological. As the sports historian Alan Gutman first observed in his book From Ritual to Record, ancient Greek athletics, including the Olympic Games themselves, lacked a concept basic to our enjoyment, the idea of a measurable level of performance that, once achieved, sets a benchmark for future athletes to surpass. While exceptional athletes could earn sums not far removed in real purchasing power from the winnings of top 20th century players, their prestige was based on stories of their prowess, not on recorded numbers. Greek runners did not attempt, for example, to achieve a new time for a given distance, not just because they lacked chronometers, but because the concept of a record was foreign to them. Roman athletes were conscious and proud of their numbers of victories, but apparently not of performance statistics as we know them. High-performance equipment was absent from Greek sport, partly because most of the events required almost none at all, even clothing was forbidden, and partly because there was no incentive to achieve a new record score. Yet sport as we know it today can hardly be separated from technology. The modern Olympics themselves depended first on railroad and steamship schedules and now rely upon airline services. The staggering expense of producing them today can be offset only by sales of broadcasting, sponsorship, and other rights at correspondingly high prices, justified to advertisers by potential worldwide television audiences in the hundreds of millions. Interestingly, sport as such a global force was unimagined in the predictions of bookish 19th-century political economists. Marx certainly made room for leisure in his post-revolutionary utopia, but the Eastern European sports machine that once awed the world in his name would surely have astonished him. Marx's own lifetime, 1818 to 1883, coincided with what the American sports historian John Rickards Betts called a technological revolution, embracing not only transportation of teams and spectators, but electrical transmission of sports news to nascent mass media. There are two sides to the unforeseen consequences of sports technology. One reflects the multiplication of chronic health problems, the other the paradox that sports is the one field in which a technology can be too good. In this century, coaches and scientists have rationalized professional and amateur sports with a vengeance, raising them to levels of system and performance that many other professions might envy. In fact, the ideology of the amateur now stands largely discredited as a vestige of 19th-century middle-class prejudice against career athletes. Here, the still useful word amateur is merely a briefer synonym for recreational athlete, not an endorsement of bygone snobbery. The quests for industrial efficiency and for sports supremacy have gone hand in hand. Promoted to neutralize the mental fatigue of school and factory work, athletics were soon subjected to studies of time and motion. In 1900, a French commission used advanced motion recording instruments to judge the precise methods and the effects of different sports on the organism and to compare their value from a hygienic standpoint. Ever since, the scientific study of industrial efficiency and the pursuit of maximum athletic performance have been raising the bar, literally and figuratively. The physiques of today's actors shows the results. Compare Johnny Weissmuller with Arnold Schwarzenegger, or Kirk Douglas with Sylvester Stallone. Equipment is generally lighter and stiffer. Video recorders that would have made the early French Commission pant with envy are honing the performance of athletes at all levels. While computer-assisted teaching has yet to prove its value in the classroom, computer analysis of sports performance has a solid record of success on the playing field. The advances of both technology and technique, nevertheless, have limits. Improvements of protective equipment have not stopped lawsuits claiming that the same equipment has been the cause of injury. New designs have led to multi-million-dollar claims against sports associations. As we will see, projectiles that can fly higher and farther have sometimes threatened the lives of spectators and judges. A flourishing athletic drug culture defies medical advice, official sanctions, and police investigation. Operations intended to restore performance can lead to agonizing disability. And while new technology can reduce the cost of a sport, aluminum alloy baseball bats, for example, it can also multiply it, racing boats. Danger, direct or vicarious, is part of the interest in most athletic competition. The fans of each sport have, at any point, a baseline of expected risk. Technology can do a lot to change the apparent danger of a sport. If the participants and spectators wish, it can affect the reality, too. Consider the bicycle. With its high center of gravity, jolting ride on paving stones or dirt, and tendency to pitch the rider forward, the picturesque, giant-wheel, penny-farthing cycle was a menace to its rider. But even falls from the far more stable safety cycle in use for the last 100 years can cause severe brain injury. Until the last 20 years or so, the only widely available head protection was the racer's leather helmet. More recently, helmets of lightweight polymer foam for shock absorption, covered with a thin, high-impact shell, have offered both greater protection and more comfort than their predecessors. According to some studies, wearing helmets can reduce the death rate from cycling injuries by 90%. Death and brain injury rates from bicycle accidents declined sharply where legislation and publicity have increased children's use of the helmets. While many children and adults still resist wearing helmets, there is little doubt that they work, that technological innovation, as we have seen so often, does mitigate dangers great and small. Recreational boating is another success story. In the water, as on land, technology and regulation, and perhaps some effects of congestion, have combined to make boating safer even as the number of boats has multiplied. Some worry that electronic navigation aids, especially satellite positioning equipment, may encourage boaters to ignore traditional navigation skills. A colleague in technology studies, himself a boater, recently raised this possibility in an electronic discussion group. But this plausible revenge effect has yet to appear. U.S. Coast Guard statistics show that while the number of U.S. pleasure boats more than tripled from 1962 to 1992, from nearly 6 million to over 20 million, annual fatalities declined from 1,114 to 816, reducing the fatality rate per 100,000 boats from 18.7 to only 4.0 per year. While the total rate of accidents seems to have dropped less sharply, legally mandated technological improvements and a campaign against drunken boating have been a powerful force. Between 1972 and 1991 alone, the Coast Guard issued more than 50 new regulations and amendments, covering everything from flotation standards and standardized visual distress signals to devices, similar to the interlocks in automobiles, for preventing outboard motors from starting in gear. Other sports have also become truly safer. Luge, with 80-mile-per-hour runs, was barred from the Olympics until the 1960s as too hazardous, but has improved crash safety by introducing lighter sleds, Kevlar helmets, face protectors, and redesigned tracks. Of course, there is always the chance that perceived safety will attract more novice athletes and thus multiply at least minor injuries. And in fencing, for example, better materials for weapons and clothing have led to more dangerous styles of play. But in general, new materials for protective equipment have consistently reduced sports casualties, that is, the catastrophic ones. If anything, professional and amateur athletes are probably too slow in adopting new protective equipment, especially polycarbonate eye and face shields in sports where flying balls or opponents' fingers are likely to cause eye damage. In the most dangerous sport of all, horseback riding, not coincidentally the least technologically changed, resistance to helmets is still strong. In the United States, more than 121,000 people sought emergency room treatment for riding injuries in 1989 to 1990, but programs to promote the use of helmets have reduced injuries significantly among amateurs. Of course, competitive riding and professional racing are likely to remain potentially lethal. Of America's 2,000 jockeys, an average of 2 die and 2 suffer catastrophic injury each year. Their polycarbonate helmets and Kevlar vests, spin-offs of military gear, mitigate injuries but cannot prevent them, nor does such gear protect a rider's legs when a horse rolls over them. It is not clear that jockeys take any more risks with their special gear than without. As risk-taking professionals who find health insurance almost unavailable, they are already exerting themselves and their horses at the highest levels of which they are capable. Yet in other sports, especially contact sports in which a lack of protection does give athletes second thoughts about striking with maximum force, safety equipment can make a game more dangerous because it encourages rougher play. Or it may in turn lead to changes in rules, changes that will at least temporarily offset the gains of the new technology. It is wrong to think that all safety measures are futile, that athletes will inevitably misuse them to maintain a steady level of risk. They sometimes do and sometimes don't. But rulemaking counts as much as technology. By prescribing and proscribing equipment, association executives and professional athletes shape the future of their sports. The political scientist Langdon Winner has underscored the power that can reside in things. For example, in the bridge abutments of Robert Moses' Long Island parkways, which may have been designed in part to exclude buses and thus limit mass transit and low-income development on Long Island. He calls this power, quote, the politics of artifacts, unquote. A livelier ball, a faster surface, or a new refueling system may either stimulate or reduce revenues of professional players, entrepreneurs, and manufacturers. Decisions about technology are political ones, determining the balance of power among competitors. Boxing. Where players and spectators enjoy the direct display of force to begin with, there is less technology can do and more room for revenge effects. The last 100 years or so of professional boxing shows this all too well. As the historian Elliot J. Gorn has noted, John L. Sullivan's national tours in the 1880s left no doubt that real men could fight with gloves and play by the Queensberry rules. Quote, the ring continued to call forth images of primitive brutality, of lower class and ethnic peoples venting their violent passions. But gloves and new rules appeared to curb the animality sufficiently to allow a titillating sense of danger inside safe and civilized boundaries, unquote. Electric lighting, as Gorn also points out, also helped transform the boxing ring from disreputable diversion into commercially raffish evening spectacle. The new conditions, of course, were intended for the benefit of promoters, not fighters. The gloves and lighting were parts of another scheme to intensify the match, preventing boxers from wrestling or colluding to slow down, the illumination exposing them to better scrutiny. Industrial employers of the same period, not coincidentally, were experimenting with production methods they hoped would discourage the workers' informal limitation of their pace, or soldiering. These continued dangers of the ring were intended, not inadvertent. Together, gloved hands, standard 3-minute rounds with 1-minute rest periods, and a reduction of knockout time from 30 to 10 seconds quickened the pace of the sport. It was now definitely worth the far smaller risk of a broken hand to land a hard blow to the head. In 30 seconds, an opponent would nearly always have been able to get up and resume fighting. Gloves also promoted roundhouse punches by weighting and protecting boxers' hands. A British Medical Association report has even compared them to the infamous hand weight, the cestus of Roman gladiators. But there was another effect of gloves that neither promoters nor athletes understood, and that was indeed a revenge effect. They multiplied cumulative chronic damage. Gloved play and the managed interest in the knockout blow encouraged boxers to land one hit after another on the side of the opponent's face. Bouts were sometimes as brutally bloody as the old bare-knuckle fights, but more often the greatest damage was not apparent. Today we know that the rotational blows of respectable boxing are far more harmful over the years than the straight punches of the bare-knuckle prize fight on the open countryside of the early 19th century. The friction of a leather glove against an opponent's skin rotates the head, gradually destroying layer after layer of nerve cells, killing the axons of others, and forming clumps of useless material in the brain. The bill of a California acorn woodpecker decelerates at 1,000 times the force of gravity, or 250 times the force on an astronaut's body at liftoff. Yet because the bird's head moves straight forward, its brain case provides protection. You will never see a punch-drunk woodpecker. Some physicians believe that long-term eye damage from the repeated blows is an even more serious problem than chronic brain injury. In fact, gloves or no, professional boxers appear to age twice as fast as non-boxing males, and physicians' groups regularly call for abolition of the sport. Boxing does not seem to be changing under the weight of criticism from doctors or the press. Some say it is even more intense than ever. A former light heavyweight champion, Jose Torres, described the experience of a really hard blow thus, quote, "It is like 1 million ants get into your brain and into your whole body," unquote. And he added that while he took only 3 such blows in his whole career, quote, "Today fighters get hit like that 3 times in 1 round," unquote. Still, it appears to be the repetition of lighter punches rather than knockout blows that causes Parkinsonism and other chronic neurological conditions in boxers. Gloves also are no protection against the serious eye damage that many boxers suffer. Some of them blame the thumb of the glove for inadvertent injury. Boxing with gloves need not have these severe long-term consequences. College boxing is a relatively safe sport, and studies of amateur athletes do not show the same brain damage as that suffered by professional fighters. The professional sport's medical notoriety seems to have encouraged conservative calls at amateur events. But the pain of the sport and its myth of social mobility bought with blood are exactly what attracts bourgeois authors no less than middle American fans. Joyce Carol Oates has put the dilemma perfectly. Without its excesses, the sport, quote, "becomes less satisfying on a deep unconscious level, more nearly resembling amateur boxing. Yet as boxing remains primitive, brutal, bloody, and dangerous, it seems ever more anachronistic, if not obscene, in a society with pretensions of humanitarianism," unquote. Football and the perils of padding. Football shows as clearly as boxing how 20th century technology tends to convert catastrophic injury to chronic ailment. And as with boxing or any other sport, what matters is less the equipment used than the tacit understanding among players, coaches, and spectators concerning the application of force. A former college player, Brendan Kinney, wrote, quote, "The 30-some pounds of equipment a football player wears are not for protection. The pads and helmets are made of hard plastics and steel. The helmet alone can weigh 8 pounds, and when propelled by a 220-pound man at about 13 miles an hour, becomes a weapon of fantastic destruction," unquote. Rugby, played without helmet or shoulder padding, is known to be less violent than football, though it is still as rough as it looks. It has a high rate of major injuries resulting in absence from multiple games. Some officials acknowledge that, like football, it is a collision sport as well as a contact sport. Its accident rate lies about midway between soccer and ice hockey. One English study of the professional game in the late 1980s found well over twice the amateur soccer accident rate per 1,000 participant days. Waves of major injuries have beset British professional rugby as they have U.S. football. Still, there is no comparison with body-armored American football for major casualties. An Australian study underscored the virtual absence of major concussions and the small number of minor ones. Not adopting helmets clearly had a reverse revenge effect as far as the head and probably the spine were concerned. Rough as American football is now, it once was still more violent when it began as an elite diversion. President Theodore Roosevelt declared his hearty contempt for any young man who, quote, counts a broken arm or collarbone as of serious consequence when balanced against the chance of showing that he possesses hardihood, physical prowess, and courage, unquote. And it was with more admiration than horror that the president of the University of California, Benjamin Ide Wheeler, described the game as, quote, two rigid rampart-like lines of human flesh, unquote, with the offense forming, quote, a catapult to fire through a porthole opened in the offensive rampart, a missile composed of four or five human bodies globulated about a carried football, unquote. The game had evolved from rugby to become a rigorously coordinated and meticulously choreographed team event, but its casualty rate became a national scandal, and while there were only a few deaths in intercollegiate play in 1905, 23 men died that year in intramural games and practice. Roosevelt threatened to outlaw the sport, and it took two sets of rule changes in 1905 and 1910 to end the most serious carnage. The college presidents and coaches who worked out the new rules were intensely conscious of the importance of managing spectator interest. The forward pass, once a controversial dreamlike play, helped attract a mass public following in the 1920s. Equally important was the acceptably smaller number of catastrophic injuries. It may have been the experience with the helmet in the First World War, the first major conflict fought with metal head protection, that led to rubber-lined headgear. Since steel was obviously too heavy, players continued to wear padded leather until after the Second World War. Plastic helmets were introduced in 1939, but were not used widely until after the war. Well into the 1950s, there were college holdouts. In fact, Haverford College players wore leather McGregor helmets as late as 1967. Richard F. Malacray, a Princeton trainer who was on the staff at the time, believes the school's conservatism reflected an enduring suspicion that hard helmets promoted more aggressive play. Where plastic helmets were adopted, players intent on using maximum force to stop an opponent began to use their headgear, with the mouthguard that soon accompanied it, as a battering ram. This intensifying tactic all too often had its own unintended consequence: spinal fracture and paralysis. Dr. Joseph Torg, an orthopedic surgeon at Temple University and later the University of Pennsylvania, began to analyze spinal injuries in the mid-1970s and discovered that broken necks and damaged spinal cords were not random accidents. Studying films of actual games, Torg found that stronger helmets introduced in the 1960s and 1970s for better protection enabled players to use their heads as battering rams. When they bent their heads forward, the spine straightened. Like a freight train hitting an obstacle on the track, the spinal column, propelled by the body's momentum, kept moving after the helmet struck its target. What seemed to be a technological solution had become an extension of the medical problem. College and professional officials had been trying to solve the same dilemma that Roosevelt faced: keeping the sport rough and bruising, but free from disabling catastrophic injury. Once more, conspicuous disaster led to remarkable, if incomplete, improvement. The NCAA banned aggressive use of the helmet in 1976, and injuries dropped. Medical catastrophes in professional and school games combined dropped from 36 in 1968 to 15 in 1989 and 2 in 1991. Even though standards officials and sports organizations have so far been unable to agree on a single prescribed design, there are now two competing standards, coaching, training, and emergency care have improved. And perhaps because there is still no universally accepted optimum design, litigation against helmet makers has continued. In 1988, Rawlings Sporting Goods stopped making helmets after courts had levied $39 million in judgments against it and other manufacturers in the 8 years since 1980 alone. Spearing, the use of a helmet in place of the shoulders to knock down an opponent, is now banned, but is still widespread, and not just in professional play. The middle linebacker Mike Singletary broke an average of four of the extra-tough helmets during each of his 4 years at Baylor. As the football critic Rick Thielander pointed out, these were helmets strong enough to withstand the impact of a baseball bat. Whatever courts may rule about the responsibility of equipment makers, the burden of constant vigilance is on officials, coaches, and trainers to prevent potentially lethal but tempting behavior. Artificial grass, first famous in the 1960s when the Houston Astrodome installed AstroTurf, was supposed to make football more widely playable rather than safer to play. Still, the choice of this surface had a revenge effect. Coaches relished the superior traction it provided. What they did not realize was that star players would be sidelined more often with patellar tendon injuries, torn ligaments, and damaged toes. One carefully controlled study of knee injuries in NFL games in the 1980s showed significantly higher rates of knee sprains on AstroTurf, even allowing for all other factors. Like other new technologies, it also takes much more care, maintenance, and vigilance than people expected. Stadiums with well-maintained artificial turf, like Cincinnati's Riverfront, have safety records much better than those without. But even the good safety statistics of some artificial turf arenas may conceal yet another instance of damage from repeated stresses. Phil Sims, the New York Giants quarterback, told the filmmaker and former college player Robert Carmichael, quote, "Playing on grass is a much easier game than playing on artificial turf. Grass is rarely frozen or lumpy. The jarring of this artificial surface takes its toll. After a game on the turf, my lower back is tight, and I can feel it in my legs," unquote. The real problem of artificial turf, though, is likely to be the same as the ultimate revenge effect of the armored style of American football. Intense recruiting, more strength and endurance training, greater conditioning, and illegal but ubiquitous steroids have made the players bigger and faster than ever, and impacts correspondingly more serious. Linemen of the 1990s would overwhelm their already massive counterparts of the 1960s. Medical and surgical technology, from helicopter evacuation to arthroscopy to hip replacement, and with superb rehabilitation equipment, have returned athletes who otherwise might have been permanently disabled to active playing careers and restored function to those who might have become paraplegics or quadriplegics. This improvement, however, has led to the biggest revenge effect of all, the prevalence of chronic conditions among former professionals and even many college players. While there are fewer catastrophes, most of which result from spearing and other dangerous practices, serious injuries have actually increased with the spread of better protective equipment. From the First World War through the 1950s, only 4 in 10 professional players per season reported injuries that needed surgery or resulted in prolonged absence from the game. By the 1980s, 7 in 10 were seriously hurt each season, according to a study by the NFL Players Association. Through the 1950s, only 1 player in 3 needed surgery. In the 1970s and 1980s, this jumped to 2 out of 3. Technology, from helmets and padding to training aids, has helped intensify the game to the point that Dr. Robert Goldman, a leading sports physician, has compared a hit by a pro player to the impact of a small car. The game's ballistic style calls for brief but powerful bursts, expressed as joint and vertebrae jarring collisions far more severe than those of Theodore Roosevelt's day. The helmets, face shields, mouthpieces, and padding are better than ever, and deaths may be rare, but neither protective nor conditioning technology can prevent damage to the joints. Since massive injections of anti-inflammatory drugs and painkillers make it possible for battered athletes to return to play, the new intensity means trading immediate relief for long-term disability. In fact, the more macho branch of sports medicine, with its multiple injections, fits in all too well with the play-with-pain ethic football players have come to accept, actually increasing long-term injury. Knee and hip surgery can extend players' careers, but usually only at the price of later pain, inflammation, and repeated rounds of surgery. During 20 years after leaving the game, the New York Jets quarterback Joe Namath needed 4 operations to repair tendons, cartilage, and ligaments in his knees. By 1992, his left knee was buckling, and surgeons replaced both knees with artificial joints. Strangely, such experiences have not stopped even recreational athletes from demanding hip replacements to continue playing. Shoulder and elbow injuries have left some players unable to raise their hands to brush their teeth. The better technologies for recovery from acute injuries become, the more severe the chronic consequences. One study of NFL players' long-term health showed that two-thirds of those who had played in the 1970s and 1980s retired with a chronic injury. Recreational athletics. Of course, football and boxing are anomalous. There are few really recreational football players. Even most college games are either professional or semi-professional. The fans demand unusual intensity, and the athletes themselves are not only exceptionally large and agile, but also among the greatest stoics in sports, meeting pain with resolute denial. Long-term disabilities may be honorable battle wounds. It is not clear that many boxers or football players regret their careers, but what of sports that remain predominantly amateur in character? The good news is that the health benefits of most forms of vigorous exercise more often than not offset the risks. A sedentary person is far more likely to suffer a chronic ailment in middle or later life than an active one. But it may not be easy to see in advance which technologies and practices are healthy. And our techniques for measuring the effects of exercise leave many questions open about where revenge effects might set in. Running. Think first about the costs and benefits of running. Synthetic materials of the 1970s made running regularly on ordinary surfaces more efficient by absorbing shocks and improving stability. In fact, running shoes became the comfort benchmark for all footwear. But these very advantages of better shoes also made it easier to run longer distances more often, multiplying stresses to joints, tendons, muscles, and bones. With each step, runners experience loads of 3 times their own weight on their bones and joints. Minor injuries are common, especially knee problems, even if with proper care these are not serious. Among long-distance runners, some women lose so much calcium that they are at risk of developing osteoporosis, although more moderate running can help maintain bone density. Runners with proper technique and no physical abnormality do not face higher risk of developing arthritis and other joint diseases than do others. But many have skeletal or joint conditions that predispose them to injury, up to half of all middle-aged men. Nor are most physicians trained to recognize everything that may put a runner at risk. Systematic autopsies have shown that many people's knees have small congenital irregularities that might not be noticed in normal activity or detected by physical checkups, but that could nevertheless lead to problems. Some combinations of anatomy and style, such as high arches and excessive pronation, shifting of weight to the inside edge of the foot, may increase knee damage. Sports physicians who deny that heavy running schedules lead to arthritis nevertheless acknowledge that chronic damage is possible if runners continue to ignore pain. Yet pain-killing drugs make it easier to do just that. Comfort can also be unreliable. Running in expensive, heavily cushioned shoes may increase injuries by lessening the foot's ability to adjust to uneven ground and by encouraging pronation. Finally, not even running surfaces are completely understood. Nearly everyone agrees that concrete is bad, but because of its unevenness, grass can be worst of all. What this shows is that even in a sport that has undoubtedly improved the health of millions of people, repeating effects can appear. It also suggests that, especially for serious athletes, exercise demands more vigilance and maintenance than expected. Even the value of running for longevity is subject to revenge effects. Despite well-publicized tragedies like the fatal heart attack of the runner author James Fix, the sport probably does extend the lives of most participants. It may have added years to Fix's, too. He had a family history of premature death from heart disease. Intensive running improves the heart's efficiency, often raising output to double that of a sedentary person. Many distance runners have pulse rates in the 40s or even lower, though some outstanding runners have had faster rates. A lowered pulse may promote longevity simply by stretching the heart's useful life, though this has not been proved. But while running strengthens the heart's long-term fitness, it also results in immediate wear and tear. Mathematical biologists have calculated that, in theory, a vigorous running program should produce steady gains in longevity up to a point, after which the benefits of additional running time decline and eventually become negative. Even apart from analysis of the mechanisms involved, running clearly takes time that could be used for other activities. Running half an hour every day for 20 years probably adds time to one's life, but it has also probably taken a full year of one's time if transportation, warm-ups, showering, and dressing are included. Of course, few people run only for longevity. The point is that an excess of almost anything beneficial may have revenge effects. Data from the late 1980s support the idea that running and other regular exercise can, after a point, actually become hazardous to your health. Ralph Pfaffenbarger, a research physician, studied the incidence of heart attacks among men who used a stair climber and recorded their activity. The rate of all heart attacks, and especially of fatal ones, fell until it reached a certain level per week. Then it began to rise. Pfaffenbarger is on record as dismissing the increase as the result of some erroneous reporting. But there is other evidence that at a particular point exertion can become harmful. In the early 1980s, the English immunologist Lynn Fitzgerald found her health declining rather than improving when she became a star long-distance runner. She discovered signs of immunodeficiency in herself and later began to find immunosuppression among athletes with heavy training schedules. Since then, research of Fitzgerald and others has suggested that while moderate exercise strengthens the immune system, overtraining may compromise it by reducing the supply of the amino acid glutamine. Of course, since sitting in a chair puts a heavy load on the spinal column and extended bed rest is a risk factor for osteoporosis, inactivity has revenge effects too. Skiing. If more comfortable shoes can indirectly produce health problems as well as benefits, the consequences of more complex sports technologies are even harder to calculate. In skiing, new materials and techniques have transformed not only footwear, but every item of equipment from skis to outerwear. Not once, but several times over since the Second World War. And while the results have made the sport faster and more enjoyable in many ways, they have equally and unintentionally changed both performance and the patterns of injury. There is first the fact that better technological concepts are not always easy to translate into superior performance. While Americans believe in the power of technology, Timothy K. Smith of the Wall Street Journal has astutely pointed out that in most Olympic sports, where advanced equipment provides a decisive edge, it is Europeans who have won more medals. Americans, ironically, excel in track and field, boxing, basketball, and other sports in which performance reflects more closely the intrinsic ability of players. Thomas P. Hughes has also noted another hidden advantage of Europeans, a core of artisans skilled in the unwritten rules of high-quality custom production, arts neglected by Americans bent on the perfection of high-volume goods for the mass market. In the long run, it is difficult to keep any technology out of the hands of competing athletes, and some sports require that equipment used by any team be available for a reasonable time to all competitors. Profound as the changes brought by new equipment and materials to boxing, football, and running have been, the transformation of skiing and of skiing safety has been greater still. The replacement of wood by plastics and composites in the 1950s changed and extended the sport just as dramatically as lifts had done earlier in the century. Gone were the rituals of waxing, and on the way out, it seemed at the time, were the broken bones that once formed part of the folklore of skiing. At first, the new equipment shifted some of the injury from ankle fractures, common with lower pre-war boots, to twisting fractures of the tibia. A fall often led to this spiral break of the bone. Then came further improvements. New rigid plastic boots and bindings employing strong, lightweight alloys were designed to release the legs of skiers at a predetermined level of force. The boots encourage a crouching position that novices find unfamiliar at first, but they promised a superior level of protection. Once more, there have been unforeseen consequences of new designs. For careful skiers, both downhill and cross-country skiing are safer than ever. In fact, skiing now has a significantly lower injury rate than tennis, a rate that includes beginners' accidents and probably understates its safety for experienced skiers. Still, the safety technology of skiing has revenge effects that can make some accidents more serious than they would be otherwise. These may be divided into two groups, voluntary risk seekers and the rank and file. To the extent that skiers are risk seekers, they will respond to safer equipment and more carefully maintained slopes by seeking more dangerous runs and increasing their speed. For championship athletes, there is no doubt that speeds are higher. In World Cup skiing, they have gone from 75 to 90 miles per hour for men and from 60 to 75 miles per hour for women, thanks to new ski and binding designs. Even cross-country skiers can reach 50 miles per hour with rigid fiberglass skis on a downhill stretch of a groomed track. When the Austrian skier Ulrike Meyer lost control fatally in the 1994 World Cup at Garmisch-Partenkirchen, one official acknowledged that, quote, "We're pressing the envelope of what these bodies can do," unquote. Protection also leads to greater risk-taking in the slalom event, where skiers voluntarily use protective gear, including helmets, to take a straighter course down the slope, touching the flexible gates lightly with their bodies as they go, instead of having to swing entirely clear of them. Among amateur skiers, too, especially younger enthusiasts, there are signs that better equipment and greater perceived safety have led to riskier skiing. American resorts have invested millions in advanced and extreme runs for these customers without having a consistent scale for marking them, using slogans like, "Make the mountain bleed." New resorts like Crested Butte, Colorado, offer slopes of up to 55%. Manufacturers promote extreme skis and even extreme sunglasses. The result is that despite lower fatalities and accidents under typical conditions, and despite some of the most expert and best-equipped ski patrols on conventional slopes at Crested Butte, the number of misadventures on extreme terrain has increased. Catastrophic ski injuries jumped from a plateau of 30 per season in the 1980s to 75 per season in 1992. Thus, in downhill skiing, there is at least preliminary evidence that some sports interests and some athletes are using safety technology to reintroduce danger. Since only a small minority of skiers, and mainly younger ones, are either professionals or temperamentally risk-takers, the major revenge effects of better equipment lie elsewhere, in the kinds rather than in the number of injuries. In the days of wooden skis, the cast-encased leg was a cartoonist cliché, but with some reason. The ankle fractures of that time were relatively common. Though painful, they healed within a month or two. Between 1960 and 1980, the proportion of ski injuries to the foot and ankle plummeted from 45 to 10% of all injuries, and all lower extremity injuries dropped from 80 to 55%. Knee injuries have remained constant at 20%, while arm, hand, head, and torso injuries increased relative to others. It is the change in knee damage that caused special concern. Robert Johnson, an orthopedic surgeon, has worked with Carl Ettlinger, an equipment consultant, for more than 20 years trying to solve the riddle of knee sprains. Skiers have been spraining anterior cruciate ligaments, ACLs, more often than medial collateral ligaments, MCLs. The small ACL connecting patella and tibia is essential for stable leg movement. ACL injuries are not only more immediately painful, but have alarming long-term consequences if not properly treated. Knee cartilage can break down, and arthritis can develop. In the 1980s, videotape analysis made it clear to Johnson and Ettlinger that equipment was playing a major part in producing such injuries. Most recreational skiers with ACL sprains, it turns out, were twisting their knees during maneuvers to stop or to keep from falling backward. Hard molded boots and more responsive bindings evolved together. Both were designed not only for easier skiing, but to prevent that earlier scourge of skiers, the tibia fracture. But the boots, bindings, and more easily maneuverable skis with side cuts can have a revenge effect when a skier falls backward. The boot and ski go off on their own, the phantom foot, with the ski applying a devastating load to the skier's knee, substituting a potential chronic condition for the old-style ski accident. ACL sprains now account for up to 6 injuries a day at large resorts and up to 100,000 annually in the United States. Surgeons can usually repair a torn MCL by stitching ends together. A sprained ACL demands much more difficult techniques, including tendon grafts. Specialized surgery can be effective but costly. Its leading practitioners are among America's most affluent doctors. Equipment designers are already studying new designs to reduce the frequency of ACL injuries without bringing back tibia fractures. Meanwhile, the answer to revenge effects is once again not technology, but vigilance. And as Ettlinger and Johnson point out, instructors do not like to teach people how to fall, even though falling is part of skiing. Improved boots and bindings represent major advances, but only with more, not less, attention to technique. Climbing. In mountaineering and rock climbing, technological revenge effects are of a different kind. In general, the technology of climbing has few direct revenge effects. It is an intensely physical sport, but one without human opponents, as in boxing and football. It is also a sport that is not intended to be safe, and in which there has always been a high rate of injury. If drivers of vehicles equipped with anti-lock brakes have more accidents than those without, we may frown on their defeating what responsible people consider the purpose of these devices, to promote safety. If climbers use new safety technology to undertake more difficult and thus riskier routes, we can't say this effect is unintended. The designers are usually top climbers themselves, and they know they are not only making the sport safer for beginners, but letting experienced climbers do what previously was impossible. In his profile of the British climber Mo Antoine for The New Yorker, A. Alvarez mentions that the highest of 7 grades in British climbing, extreme, was once reserved for only a few routes, but now has more numerical subgrades than all the other levels put together. While some top climbers, like Antoine, are prodigiously powerful, climbing did not reach the extreme level in the same manner that performance in many other sports attained new levels, by a search for previously untapped populations for athletes extraordinarily well endowed for the specific demands of an activity. Much of the improved performance of late 20th century athletes, in the West as well as in Eastern Europe, can be traced to early recognition of outstanding physical potential in a broad population. At least in the West, climbers are not generally recruited by colleges or professional teams. Instead, it was a technological revolution that began after the Second World War and that let climbers take greater risks. At first, new, harder alloys were introduced for the pitons that climbers hammered into the rock. Then it was braided filament nylon and perlon ropes that gave climbers an extra margin of safety by stretching just the right amount to break a fall. These improvements were followed by spring-loaded frens, lightweight devices with expanding comma-shaped cams that could fit rapidly and securely in crevices, and other devices that could grip tenaciously. New synthetic uppers and high-friction rubber soles subsequently improved the traction of lightweight climbing shoes, a far cry from the hobnail boots of the 1930s. Plastic helmets and nylon body harnesses reduced the danger of falls. Meanwhile, synthetic materials were improving the weather resistance of outdoor clothing. Each improvement made it possible to contemplate more difficult climbs. On the highest summits, added lightness, strength, and weatherproofing were decisive. Drier plastic boots prevented frostbite. More aerodynamic tents kept out cold. Stoves and freeze-dried rations were lighter. Insulation drier, yet breathable. David G. Addis and Susan P. Baker, public health specialists, interpreted accidents in U.S. national parks. Quote, "In contrast to the success of safe product design in preventing injuries in the home and workplace, the introduction of modern climbing equipment, designed for efficiency and safety, has been accompanied by a sharp escalation of climbing standards. Rather than decreasing, demands have increased dramatically to parallel the high performance made possible in part by better equipment," unquote. To public health professionals, the trend is indeed a revenge effect, but to climbers and perhaps to the designers of their gear, this is doubtless intentional. In fact, Addis and Baker also note that in climbing, as in other risk-oriented sports, the inexperienced novice is up to 10 times more likely to get hurt than seasoned participants, but experts may be more likely to die. Many move through a series of increasingly challenging maneuvers. Himalayan climbers, exceptionally able as a group, seem to have the highest climbing death rates of all. For similar reasons, racing drivers actually have significantly higher off-track crash rates than other motorists, despite rigorous training and superior skills. their confidence prompts them to take greater risks. These survivors among top climbers tend to be those who, like Mo Antoine, resist pushing the outer limits. In football and skiing, the weak link exposed by new technology is the knee and its anterior cruciate ligament. In climbing, it is the hand and fingers. As the orthopedic surgeon and climber Mark Robinson reminds us, our hands have evolved for precision work. Monkeys have retained the powerful forearms and tough flexor tendons ideal for rock climbing. When one climber teased them with bananas left on a cliff, they made an ascent at the very high difficulty level of 5.13. Considering the inherent risks of scaling a sheer cliff face, today's ropes, shoes, cam devices, and other equipment use new materials to superb effect. But what they cannot do is compensate for weak joint cartilage that makes certain power grips dangerous. Not only joints, but especially tendons are at risk. Just as the characteristic motions of keyboarding can inflame the carpal tunnel, repeated stress on the tendons can produce climber's finger, a sprain or strain that partially tears the tendon or stretches it painfully. In extreme cases, the annular pulleys through which the tendons pass may be broken as well. Experienced climbers are at risk not only from the more difficult ascents they attempt, a conscious and rational balance of danger against accomplishment, but even more from the insidious risk of repeated flexion. Studies of climbers cited by Robinson show that half to three-quarters have long-standing finger injuries, with many also suffering from swollen joints or deformities. Many of these have conditions that do not appear as arthritic in x-rays, but that, Robinson believes, may develop into full-blown arthritis. Carpal tunnel syndrome can appear among climbers, and inflammation of the tendons can scar the median nerve. Carefully supervised practice facilities with artificial walls may help climbers develop proper technique and confidence, but they too have potential revenge effects. Some veteran instructors are concerned that novices who learn mainly in indoor gyms may be vulnerable to accidents on less predictable real-world ascents. It is still too soon to say whether their concerns are justified. As in skiing, both conservative treatment and surgery can usually prevent potentially long-term injury from becoming chronic. It is even likely that clinical experience in dealing with knee and hand injuries in sports will lead to better procedures for treating similar conditions arising from activities at work and in the home. We have seen how military medicine has benefited civilian emergency treatment, plastic surgery, and other specialties. The study of sports injuries has also improved training and conditioning. As knowledge has increased, the attitudes of participants have also changed. Robinson observed in 1993 that within only 5 years, quote, climbers have become much more sophisticated and careful about training, and now routinely behave more like athletes than the anarchic maniacs they used to be in my glory days, unquote. Even so, climbers more than nearly all other recreational athletes have to accept chronic injury routinely. Robinson acknowledges that training and proper treatment can reduce but not eliminate these problems. Sooner or later, all serious climbers encounter injuries that probably will cause permanent damage. What care can accomplish is limiting these to a level that can be regarded as a fair price for the pleasures of climbing. The ultimate revenge effect of technology in sports is not a health problem at all, but a chronic one nonetheless. Not only for climbers, but for cross-country skiers and backpackers, gains in both climbing and rescue techniques mean that more people feel confident in taking risks. Improved transportation and more leisure have made this growth possible, yet without a greater sense of security, there might be as many sightseers, but far fewer participants. In 1951, only 300 people climbed Mount Rainier near Seattle. By 1985, the number had increased to over 4,000, with nearly 3,500 others turning back before reaching the top. Mount Hood in Oregon has 10,000 climbers a year. Mount Fujiyama in Japan has 100,000. Mount Everest in 1953 tested the ability of two of the world's strongest climbers, their conquest bringing international acclaim. But 485 people had reached the summit by late October 1992, even though from 1953 to 1973 there had been only three dozen. Technology does seem to be taking much of the fear not only out of climbing, but also out of backcountry hiking and cross-country skiing. And this is just what alarms many park officials. The recreation officer of Mount Hood National Forest told a reporter in 1986, after 11 people, including 9 members of a school expedition, died in 2 separate incidents, quote, "Mountain climbing is a dangerous sport. If you made it so safe for everybody to get up there, you'd have a lot more fatalities because people wouldn't recognize the risk," unquote. One reason for continued high fatalities in some locations, despite unprecedented safety measures, is the illusion of control that we encountered in the paradox of computer productivity. To an experienced climber with respect for the mountains and weather, improvement seemed to be mainly a chance to achieve greater success and pleasure with the same degree of risk. But others take risks without realizing their seriousness. Vacationers overestimate the safety and predictability of nature. In fact, some of the technically easiest climbs can be the most treacherous. On Mount McKinley, Denali, in Alaska, the highest mountain in the United States and Canada, of 1,000 attempts a year, about 600 are successful. It is unlikely that there would be 3 or so attempts a day if the risks did not appear reasonable and controlled, at least to the extent that climbers are backed up by helicopter rescue. Yet 11 people died in the first half of 1992 alone, 10 from falls and 1 from altitude sickness. The problem is that Mount McKinley's weather is unusually severe and unpredictable, with wind gusts of up to 200 miles an hour near the summit and fiercer cold than Everest. Weather and the altitude of climbers often prevent use of the helicopter, which critics compute costs about $200 a year to operate for every person making the attempt. Some traditionalists have called for abolishing the rescue service. "If rescues weren't so easy," wrote the editor of Climbing magazine, "maybe some of these people would have the sense not to go on the mountain." Avalanches. Not weather itself, but avalanches are the most serious threat to climbers and others on the mountain slopes, especially in winter. In the 19th century, avalanches were primarily a hazard of railroad workers and miners. Now they are a hazard largely for outdoor vacationers and athletes worldwide. In 1990, 43 climbers died in an avalanche on Mount Lenin in the Soviet Union. In 1991, 9 skiers perished at a helicopter resort in British Columbia. And over Christmas 1991, there were a death and injuries at Albertville, France, during preparations for the 1992 Winter Olympics. In the United States, avalanches kill from 15 to 20 people a year. In Europe, they kill about 120. More on average than earthquakes do. An avalanche is one of the most lethal natural disasters because victims engulfed by snow may have less than an hour to live. Prompt rescue is essential. Unlike earthquakes, avalanches tend to strike in the same areas with the requisite slopes and snowfall. They happen again and again in the same place. As a report of the U.S. National Research Council put it, quote, "Unlike other ground failure hazards such as rock slides, which once released are spent, snow avalanches automatically reload with each snowfall and can fire several times in a given year," unquote. We are only starting to understand avalanche prediction. The mathematics turn out to be exceptionally complex, an aspect of what is called self-organized criticality. The only effective ways to deal with avalanche hazards are still to keep people out of zones at risk and to create and manage small avalanches. The U.S. Forest Service and other agencies provoke slides with military gear, including artillery shells from avalanchers, shots from recoilless rifles, and helicopter-delivered bombs in hopes of preventing more serious disasters. May we consider avalanche a revenge effect of winter sports? Unlike an active fault or a forest fire, an avalanche zone, like a flood zone, is a hazard, an object of public concern, only if people live or travel in its path. We have already seen that the very features that make the forest edge and seashore attractive for living also make it dangerous. Similarly, in hopes of consistently good skiing conditions, several Austrian pensions were built in a known danger zone, with results fatal to a number of guests in the late 1980s. Typically, it is more common for skiers to die in avalanches they trigger than in structures in the path of the cascading snow. Locals, including local skiers, respect the snow as they respect other natural features. Of course, multiple deaths happened before modern sports tourism developed, often to railroad laborers and gold seekers in the U.S. West. But urban skiers, climbers, and hikers now bring a new attitude to the slopes. They are used to urban tempos and timetables. They have jobs and families in the city. If they cancel a climb or give in to prudent fear of weather or snow conditions, they may forfeit precious vacation time and often money. While these vacationers may have had years of university science, they understand the mountains less than most local dropouts do. For them, the revenge effect, the danger of technology, is precisely their feeling of immunity from natural events. The more reliable the control of avalanches is thought to be, the bolder some skiers and other winter athletes will feel. Even advanced avalanche monitoring, radio identifying signals, and public education programs have not reduced the number of accident victims. In Colorado, an all-time record of 12 deaths was recorded in the winter of 1993, mostly of climbers, backpackers, and skiers who had wandered off from approved slopes. Far from satisfying the demand for risky experience, the well-maintained, if steep, slopes of areas like Crested Butte seem to draw a minority of skiers for whom even these are too tame. People who seem determined to use every new safety measure to get more excitement at the same risk. When 7 skiers trapped by an avalanche near Aspen gained national attention in February 1993, which turned to notoriety when they offered the story of their rescue to Hollywood, it turned out they were not ordinary fools, but experienced backcountry skiers equipped with avalanche beacons that may have given them a false sense of security. Similar accidents have been reported from the mountains of Scotland and the Alps of France. Courting risk with safety devices. The growing number of backcountry deaths, like the popularity of extreme skiing, challenges the view that Western society is timid and risk-averse. The opposite seems more on the mark. Knowledgeable and experienced skiers and climbers yearn more than ever for the most challenging experiences available. The crowds on the groomed slopes at the most popular resorts and the traffic on easier climbing routes drive some people farther afield to get the same mountain experience, a recongesting effect. What an international ski tour operator told the London Times after a tragedy in the French Alps also applies in North America. Quote, "The job of a guide has changed. It's now to take people into risky situations. It used to be to avoid it. Clients often urge instructors to take risks now. An instructor will push the limits," unquote. Safety devices add risk not just because guides and clients feel safer, but because it is easy to leave them in the wrong mode or not fully activated. An example from the high seas illuminates what is happening on land. The world-class American yachtsman Michael Plant died after his 60-foot sloop capsized during a solo transatlantic voyage in October 1992. Concerned to arrive in France in time for the beginning of an around-the-world race, he had not registered his emergency position indicating radio beacon. Had its signals been recognized promptly, Plant might well have survived. His resourcefulness was legendary, and his sloop was built with multiple safety precautions, including a lifeline, a doubly protected living area, and watertight compartments. Plant's death shows that the greatest risk of safety devices may be that human beings retain the power either to operate them in the wrong mode or to disable them, as Plant did when he chose not to register the beacon. We have already seen how technology increases the need for vigilance in medicine, plant, and animal introductions, computing, and driving. It is no less true in recreational sailing, even for the most skilled. Ordinary recreational sailors and backcountry skiers face smaller risks in relying on electronic devices. The Global Positioning System, GPS, gives the recreational market nearly the same ability to find coordinates that until recently only the U.S. military possessed. By 1994, 40% of one leading maker's GPS sales were recreational. At the same time, rescue organizations were starting to report a growing number of calls from people who were lost or perhaps hurt, but not in grave danger. One of the problems of most warning technologies is that safety concerns will lead to many false alarms, which in turn may have the revenge effect of diverting attention from real emergencies. Up to 99% of electronic residential burglar alarm calls to police departments are, as we noted in Chapter 1, false and may actually weaken police efforts against crime by diverting patrol cars. My own municipality, Princeton Township, requires an initial response by a private guard service, yet another example of how automatic technologies demand more rather than less vigilance. Already in early 1994, rescue organizations were reporting multiple calls from climbers and hikers with cellular telephones requesting help in situations that response teams did not consider true emergencies. Sometimes these calls tied up lines that might have been needed for real emergencies. GPS devices might seem to help by making it harder to get lost, but they can also promote the idea that a quick rescue is always at hand. They also may remove the incentive to develop the basic wilderness skills that might still be needed if the new technologies do not work. It is too early to say whether this revenge effect is real or only hypothetical. New technology can enhance not only performance and enjoyment, but safety. Yet often it does not. As we have noticed in medicine, the environment, and the office, what begins as an improvement all too often shifts a problem or even magnifies it. Injury, acute and chronic, may remain constant or actually increase. In part, these consequences follow from spectators' expectations of violence. Helmets, gloves, and padding can all be abused to intensify combat. In fact, the suspension system of the first plastic football headgear became part of the U.S. Army helmet of the Second World War. In part, the revenge effects of sports technology also arise because participants in sports like skiing and climbing appear to want a certain level of risk. In bicycling and baseball, where risk is largely incidental to participation, safety equipment like helmets and breakaway bases has been effective. Not technology, but the values of participants and spectators determine the danger of sport. Even where attitudes help reintroduce risk, revenge effects can be overcome once we realize that the benefits of technology take far more vigilance and attention than we thought. In contact sports, this means that officials must be able to make and remake rules and enforce them for safety. And the measures they take, like football's prohibition of spearing, are only as effective as officials' determination to enforce them. It means that everyone, from physicians to park rangers and ski patrols, has to be more, rather than less, alert to abuses and dangers. Above all, it means that athletes themselves have to recognize that they are participating in more complex technological systems that need more understanding and watchfulness than they may have realized. Today, even leisure can take real work.